Hello and welcome to Beyond the Back Page on New FM with myself, Patrick Donoghue. With the summer finally here and the glorious weather we are experiencing at the moment, we thought it would be a good time this evening to chat about some great sports books, as some people will be heading on their summer holidays in the next few weeks, and indeed even if they're at work they'll be using this time with the long evenings to catch up with some reading. With this in mind, I thought it'd be a great idea to get on the show today our regular contributor Michael Hopkins. Michael usually joins us to chat to us about all the developments in League of Ireland and indeed Irish football, but we thought we'd get Michael on the show today to give us his picks of favourite sports books, some books to kind of recommend as we get into the summer. And I'm delighted to say Michael should be joining us online. Michael, thanks a million for joining us again on the show.
No problem, Paddy. Hope you're enjoying the good weather.
Yeah, we are. Well, it's kind of funny. I was looking there before I rang you. When they're issuing weather warnings for next week, it's going to be an interesting experience. And I'm actually flying out to Germany next week, and I expect it to be hotter there. So it could be if I survive that, we'll see how we go. So I might start, but Michael, you very kindly suggested three of your favourite sports books of all time, and the three books you provided us with: The Sports Gene by David Epstein, Inverting the Pyramid, The History of Soccer Tactics by Jonathan Wilson, and Provided You Don't Kiss Me, 20 Years with Brian Clough by Duncan Hamilton. We might start with that book by Duncan Hamilton, and it's kind of, we were actually had a guest on last week, John Sperling, who was chatting about football in the 1970s, and as you could imagine, Brian Clough featured so prominently because he was a central figure in the 70s, his time with Derby and then with Nottingham Forest. You might just start by telling us, Michael, what did you like about this book by Duncan Hamilton?
I think what I liked most about it was he doesn't try to sugarcoat Clough in any way at all. He pretty much examines his career from start to finish, and it's warts and all. A very flawed character, Brian Clough, as a lot of people know, achieved a huge amount in the game, but he also fell out with a huge amount of people as well. Exerted a huge amount of influence in the game, and his sheer personality rubbed a lot of people up the wrong way, not only in English football, but in football in general. I think he says himself he's probably the greatest manager never to be given the England job, and a lot of people will probably agree with that, because at the time he just wasn't seen as the right fit for what the reflection of an England manager should be. And it's funny because he could have been one of the more successful ones given the relationship he was able to build with his players. That's the thing that stood out for me the most, was behind the scenes things. So there's the small little paragraphs where they speak about the cup winners with Forrest, or even the players that he had at Derby, and every one of them will eulogise down to the ground about his methods. Not the tactically the best coach, but just a fantastic manager that could just pull the best out of every player that he had. The achievements don't really stand up. I think it's often overlooked, the achievements that he had with the two clubs that he had as well, particularly Derby and Nottingham Forest. No one would, I don't think, in this day and age would be able to achieve what he achieved, given the budget that he had, given the parochial nature of both clubs, clubs that are very closely tied to each other. He's a hero of both. And the amount of influence that he was able to exert, particularly at Forest, I think the closest person in modern times that you could compare him to is probably Sir Alex Ferguson. He literally had the running of everything from boardroom down, right down to the groundsman. The stories about how he wanted the pitch cut, how he liked the training field laid out, how he used to visit players on the fly to keep them on their toes. Man management 101. That a lot of wouldn't really hold up to in this day and age, but an absolute genius. And I'm glad Duncan Hamilton didn't try to put him on a pedestal. He explores him in great depth. So I think that's what I enjoyed most about it.
And the access levels, I'm right in saying, now I haven't read that book. And I, funny enough, I've read, there's another great book about Clough written by one of your other picks, Jonathan Wilson. He had another great book, but I think Jonathan Wilson's book is more of an overview of his whole career. But Duncan Hamilton's takes that time just when he was a manager of Nottingham Forest. And I guess what was from you talking there, Michael, it seems that Duncan's access, he seemed to have great access to Clough and the players, and probably levels of access that reporters and journalists, because I guess now we're in an era where we're watching interviews post-match, and there's not much there. Like, everything is very much media managed, and from the sound of it, that was not the case. Duncan Hamilton seemed to have a level of access that would not really exist today.
I think his family, Clough's family, certainly gave a level of access that I didn't see, and because there's obviously there's a few documentaries around Clough as well, that you get a lot of ex-players that will speak about him, but the family tend to be a little bit more reserved. In particular, his son Nigel doesn't speak a huge amount about his father, probably because he doesn't want to draw too many comparisons either, given his career in the game. But there was one quote that stood out. Was, I think I just wrote it down there because it jumped out at me. Clough spoke to Hamilton and said, "One day you'll write a book about this club. No, actually, one day you'll write a book about me, but promise me you'll save it up and you'll only release it when it won't do any harm." So Clough himself knew that some of the pearls of wisdom and stuff that he had given the journalists over the year, or had given to players and to staff and stuff like that over the year, they didn't repeat them, because they'd nearly be offensive, or they nearly offend someone in the game. He never held back. And you're right, the level of access is very good. It's paced very well. It explores in great detail, from the very beginning right down to the end, and at a very sad end to Clough's career. Unfortunately, he became a bit of a figure of fun because he couldn't keep the club in the Premier League, and a club very close to his heart, and his health and his mind started to fade there as well. These are very touchy subjects for his family to go into. Anyone can sit and talk about how great their father or grandfather or brother or husband is when they're winning European Cups, but not a lot of them want to speak about their mental health towards the end of their life, or how they were a victim of alcoholism. And so it is, you're right, the level of access is very enjoyable. And it's not, I did enjoy Jonathan Wilson's book, I will say. He does go into slightly more detail in terms of his whole career, but this is a focused opinion on Clough, and it's very enjoyable for it.
No, it sounds like I've just ordered it from the library, and I'm looking forward to reading it. And you mentioned the sadness. One of the saddest aspects of the Brian Clough story is that, certainly in the book, Jonathan Wilson's book, it talks about the relationship with Peter Taylor, and they just seemed to be just one of these beautiful friendships. They were both obsessed with football, and there's great sadness that they fell out, and I don't think, you might correct me if you're wrong, they never really reconciled. I guess Brian Clough, he was a flawed character. He was a brilliant manager, but I suppose no more than a lot of great people, there was, he had his demons. But that particular aspect, the fallout with Peter Taylor, that is a very, very sad aspect of the Brian Clough story.
It is, and I you're right in what you said about they balanced each other out beautifully. Taylor would often be aghast at some of the suggestions that Clough would have, but almost have to hold his hands up and admit that, the genius had shone through and he was right. Whereas I think Clough was less inclined to give the spotlight over to Taylor, but you can tell how close they were, how well they worked together, and how big of an impact they had on both of their careers when they had that acrimonious falling out. Both tried to carry on the game. Both were never nearly as successful as they were when they were together. And it's a shame, it is a shame, that these two people that walked so closely together, that created this dynasty that they can look back on that they never really reconciled towards the end of their lives. Clough was a hard man to come around to change his opinions, and I'd imagine it was probably more on his side he was reluctant to reconcile than it was on Taylor's. But they're both very proud men, both had a huge history in the game, so I'd imagine their egos there were very hard to back down from the fall. And it had been coming, cracks had been appearing, so it wasn't a huge surprise, and it's covered very well in the book. Without wanting to go into too much detail, Taylor comes across very well in the book. He's spoken about very well, but his flaws are also examined in the book as well. And it's not a hit piece. You can tell it's done with care, it's done with honesty, and it covers that relationship in very well, very good detail.
Yeah, and the thing, Duncan Hamilton is a beautiful writer. I think he, just a couple of years ago, he won the William Hill Sports Book Awards for a book about cricket. And I should have done my research better, but if my memory serves me correctly, I think it's Brett of Sadness. And it's basically after his wife passed away, and he spoke about how going to Day International's cricket matches kind of gave him great comfort at that time. And it's meant to be, again, I love books like that. Sometimes soccer and Gaelic would be my primary sports, but I love sometimes when you hear about a book that is about a subject that is, you mightn't be totally familiar about, but it's when it's so beautifully written, it really, really kind of brings you. So that's really highly recommended by Provided You Don't Kiss Me. You might move on to your second pick, and it's another football book. And I started looking, I actually had this marked as a book to read during lockdown, but didn't quite get round to it. Inverted the Pyramid, The History of Soccer Tactics by Jonathan Wilson, who, from my mind, I think he's just a brilliant writer, very detailed. People might come across, he writes for The Guardian, and his articles are always very interesting, very detailed. And this book, History of Soccer Tactics, Inverting the Pyramid, it's a read you have to give a bit of time to, but it's absolute, the detail is fascinating about the evolution of football to what we have now. Can you tell us what was it about the book that you really liked, Michael?
I think you're right in what you're saying around the detail, Paddy. I think this is almost the exact opposite to the book we spoke about first, in that Duncan Hamilton's very good at putting across the human side of sports stars or sports, whereas Jonathan Wilson is more analytical. He's able to step back and have a bird's eye view of changes across decades in how football has evolved. I remember reading this book first when I just started coaching, just underage teams. And it was actually a friend of mine coaching the team with me. And at the time, there was an enthusiasm, I think, for both of us to absorb as much knowledge as we could around football. It's almost like, having stopped playing and now coaching, we now looked at football in a different way. So this is one of the books that I picked up just to sort of get an oversight of the game. And what struck me most is how well Wilson's able to tie what we consider modern facets of soccer all the way back to the 1940s, even earlier, late 1900s, the way the sport evolved in Central Europe, the way it evolved in South America, how Scandinavian countries developed, how that influenced English soccer culture, stuff like that, and how it slowly spread from continent to continent with the increasing levels of technology that we have. So at this moment in time, you and I can turn on the TV and we can see South American football. We can see football from any part of the world that we want to see. But what Wilson covers well is these technological advances and this ability to watch football from anywhere, it didn't exist. And what it reminded me of, and it might remind you of if you do read it, was I remember as a kid sitting down to watch a World Cup and having never heard of half some of the players that had played. My first memory of the World Cup is Italia 90, so supporting Ireland, coming up against players that you don't see week in, week out, week in, week out. You don't see formations. You don't see passing football. You don't see exciting football in the way that you would on the continent now. And Wilson explains the evolution of that, how it's now forming thinking of coaches like Pep Guardiola, Jurgen Klopp, how they have their history in total football under Johan Cruyff, and how that feeds into Guardiola's philosophy today. So for anybody who has an interest in sort of soccer tactics or formations, or how we ended up in a situation now where two of the best teams in the world, Man City and Liverpool, got to where they are and the type of football that they play, how that builds upon foundations that were years and decades in the making. So it does give a really good overview of soccer, how it has evolved. But like I said, the level of detail from Jonathan Wilson is astonishing.
Yeah.
So be prepared for a quiet room. It's not one to read on the beach, I don't think.
Yeah, but I've read, so the thing I really love about Jonathan Wilson's book, it is like, it's not a light read, but at the same time, what I love about his writing is he's wrote a book about Argentinian football. He's wrote a book about Hungarian football. I think he, I actually tried Michael once to get he's one of my dream guests. I was trying to get him onto the show, but unfortunately he hasn't got back to me. So if he's listening by any chance, but no, he's an absolutely brilliant. But the thing, thing I love about his books is that he brings in you. It helps if you're a football fan, but if you're interested in history and politics, you really take a lot, because he goes into that level of detail. And I might ask you about the I loved his, he wrote a book about Hungarian football, which I found fascinating, and that was one another a vital thing, a thing that you were talking there about teams that you wouldn't have come across. And it was a Hungarian team in the 50s, and just that great Hungarian team, and the Bet England, I think it was 5-3, and the football that was playing, it just absolutely flabbergasted the English. Is that covered in the book? I hope I'm not putting you on the spot, Michael.
No, he covers it in great detail, because the evolution of that type of football arrived, and he explains it by the connectivity that we have today for coaches to reach out to each other and get information. That was all covered in European coffee houses. So people that thought about the game, people that coached the game, people that played the game, they met up and they spoke about football, and it drove the education of coaching and the evolution of soccer tactics across Europe. But because the British game, and England and Ireland probably in particular, island nations, didn't have that culture, or they didn't have that immediate connection to the European to the Central Europe, they almost fell behind, and they almost developed their own sense of soccer tactics. So plenty of people will know that it was a very direct game that stayed with the English game for years, very much an emphasis on you know, going forward quickly, physicality, athleticism, and so on. So when this Hungarian team arrived to play England and Wembley, they were massively underrated and expected to be soundly beaten. But they employed tactics that the English team had never really come up against on a regular basis. So they possession football, trying to walk the ball forward into advantageous positions, a different shape. So what we know as now as the false nine, which is very prevalent in the game today, and everyone throws it around, were one of the first teams to employ that. So their centre-forward dropped off into midfield to create an overload against the English team, and they were completely bamboozled by it. So again, that was a shock to the system for the English game, not one that it learned from, but other European nations then start taking on this, and they all evolved into their own styles then. So it's an excellent piece on that Hungarian team that didn't achieve the success that they should, but the influence that they have over the game. And he covers stories like that very well. One that's very relevant in this day and age as well is someone that Wilson covers quite a lot in his books is Marcelo Bielsa. So he'll eulogise till the day he dies about Bielsa and his philosophy on the game. It's not necessarily one that will win a lot of trophies, nor did the man win a lot of trophies himself. But he's a romantic, and he believes that the game should be played in a particular way. And Wilson brings that across. So as he travels through the different stages and the different changes that happen in the game, he explains one side is resistant to change, to this type of football, and the other side that's driving it. And it's very interesting to see how the change happens and how it slowly spread from one side of particularly Europe, but then South America, Central America, African nations as well. How it spread across that is very interesting as well.
No, it sounds absolutely fascinating. And again, I'm going to try. Summer holidays is coming up for myself, so I'm going to put that in one of the books to read. Might move on to your final pick, The Sports Gene, David Epstein. I must admit, I don't know an awful lot about this book. I've heard of David, and I know he's a really excellent sports scientist. But you might tell us a little bit about this book, Michael.
Yes, yeah, so this one is totally unrelated to the previous two, and that it takes a parachuted look down on sports in general and how we as humans develop different abilities and different avenues that we follow in terms of sports. And there was a great thinking a couple of years ago around the theory of 10,000 hours, and that no matter what, I think it was Malcolm Gladwell's books coined the phrase 10,000 hours, that pretty much said for any sport or any profession or any vestitude that you wanted to perfect, you needed to put in a minimum of 10,000 hours, and that anyone who put in that practice for that period of time could master whatever they were trying to achieve. Now, David Epstein will argue that there are biological biases that help humans evolve in different parts of the world, among the different sexes, that give them an advantage. And what he does is he covers in great detail different, not only genders, but also races, countries, and the influences that they have on their sport and achievements. So to put it in very simple terms, if you are not born and you don't have the right genes and you're not going to be a certain height, the chances of you playing at the very top in the NBA are enormously slim. If you don't have the right frame to play a particular sport, so if you're not built big enough or you can't gain the muscle, you don't have the genes to put on the muscle that you require, you're probably not going to play prop forward for rugby. And that carries on across the whole of human evolution, really. But it also goes into great detail of affecting the mental side of it as well, the motivations that drive people and how our genes almost give a premonition of where we can go, to the point where some sporting organisations took it upon themselves to identify what the requirements were for a child to get to the highest level in sport. And if they didn't feel like they met those requirements, they changed them to a different sport. So if they didn't think that you had the height to be a basketball player, they might try to move you somewhere else. They might try identify that you might be a better tennis player, or you might be a better track and field athlete as well. So it doesn't overload the reader with a huge amount of sports science information. It covers enough in a way to get you interested in the area of sports science. And it's something that's very relevant at the moment, because a podcast that I listen to in particular is The Real Science of Sport, and their last couple of podcasts have all evolved around the issue of trans men or women competing in sport. So this book doesn't go hugely amount into that detail, but it sets up, if you wanted to carry on into further reading, into how these requirements are actually now influencing the decisions that sports makers have to make, and the Olympic committees and so on having to make. So, but David Epstein writes in a very well-written, easily informed, not too overly analytical or scientific way, and it's a very enjoyable read.
No, it sounds great. That's brilliant. That's your three picks. It's our inaugural. We said we'd try this out, something totally different, and I think it's been very, very interesting. So that your three picks are The Sports Gene by David Epstein, Inverting the Pyramid: The History of Soccer Tactics, Jonathan Wilson, Provided You Don't Kiss Me, 20 Years of Brian Clough by Donegan Hamilton. I just wrote down a few quick books. You can shout down yeah or nay if you yeah. haven't read them, or if you've come across them. My picks are Forever Young: The Story of Adrian Doherty, Football's Lost Genius, Oliver Kay. Fascinating yeah. story about Adrian Doherty.
He was with the Manchester United youth team.
He was indeed. Yeah. So that's. That's a really, really good book, and a book that might be of interest to you, Boy on the Shed by Paul Ferris, who was former Newcastle physio. Really, Paul Ferris, beautiful, beautiful writer. He was a youth player, didn't make it, but another we might have these books featured in maybe another edition of the I suppose the book review, or we'll think up a snappier title. Two non-soccer book recommendations: Open by Andre Agassi, Tiger Woods by Jeff Benedict. Again, sports I don't know an awful lot about, and but really, really good. I'm actually this might be of interest. I'm actually at the moment, Michael, reading Brian Gartland's autobiography. It's actually quite good. It's I would say now you probably would know him better, but he comes across as quite a likable character, and it's unusual. I haven't really read any books from League of Ireland players, so it's really, really, really good so far. I only started it. I picked it up from the library a couple of days ago, but that's a really, really good read. Unfortunately, Michael, this has been we're just out of time. Like, I'd love to chat more, and we were going to schedule a little talk about League of Ireland, but thanks a million for joining us, giving us your sports picks, and we might try this again, because I always think it's a great idea, sports book club. It's might something we might trial on the station. So thanks a million for joining us to give us your thoughts. So thanks again, Michael, for joining us. And Pats against Dundalk at the weekend. What's your verdict, briefly?
Oh, I'm not looking forward to it. I'm being really impressed with how well Stephen O'Donnell has stepped in and gotten Dundalk going. And I'm not 100% certain. Whilst I wouldn't be calling for Tim Clancy to go, something's not sitting right, and there's no consistency. And obviously losing Dara Burns there was a big blow as well. So I wouldn't be as confident as I normally am, put it that way.
Yeah. Well, Michael, thanks a million for that. Enjoy the match, and we will talk to you again on the show.
Thanks, Paddy.